He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Good morning to our listeners for this week's Car Keys show with Jada Markin and Robin Leach. I would like to start off talking about driving in fog. It is October when this show is being done, and there seem to be mornings in which there is a considerable amount of low-level clouds, which otherwise known as fog, that are existing in large sectors of our listening area and beyond. My experience that I want to talk about is on this day of the show, and there fog is a funny sort of situation. It moves in and out, thick to thin to non-existent, back to thin and thick again. And visibility, when it's thick, is very difficult to see when cars are unlit. That is rear tail lights if you're following cars, headlights or DRLs if you're looking for oncoming cars. I have noted in my journey to in this day's show that silver cars, light cars, are even more invisible before you actually get to see them than darker cars, especially when there are no lights on the cars that are lit up. DRLs are not necessarily suitable for cars from which you were following, because DRLs, daytime running lights, for those who don't know that, are usually just front-only lighting on cars that have them properly operating. That means the taillights are not lit up, and Jay will jump in about that in a flash or in a minute or so. And you cannot necessarily see cars that may be closer than you think when you are in thick fog conditions. When you are traveling along a highway, a multi-lane or single lane, at 70 miles an hour and the fog gets thick, here is what I suggest drivers do. If they don't have their lights on, they better get them on. But if they don't have rear lights on, and if they know that they don't have rear lights on, and I'm afraid that is probably not a very known situation for many of the drivers in these cars, old or new, get them on. But distance yourself more further behind whatever car you can't or can see, and slow down a bit from maybe a high-speed traveling MPH, miles per hour, if you cannot see anything in front of you except thick fog. Jay, you want to comment on that before I go on?
Sure. As somebody who's grown up, I grew up in Belgium with a lot of fog in September and October, pretty much every morning, a little bit like you had this morning. It's a problem. Lights are obviously the obvious first thing to do, put on. European cars have rear fog lights, and many cars have them here, even though for some reason I have a Volkswagen that does not have rear fog lights. But if you do have rear fog lights, do not hesitate to put them on, because they are way more powerful than even brake lights. And they will really help people following you see your car. The problem is very few cars overall have these rear fog lights. So and I really, you know, to this day have to wonder why. It's been 50 years now that they've had them in Europe. And we have all sorts of very strict regulations when it comes to safety in this country. But evidently, rear fog lights does not seem to be a concern on a federal level. And that's a bit of a shame. So, yes, slow down. You want to make sure you see the lights in front of you. If you don't, you know there is a problem. And slowing down without slamming on your brakes would be, you know, the reasonable and prudent thing to do. It takes a lot of concentration to drive in the fog, and you really cannot let your eyes get off, you know, the road. And I think there's not much more to say. I mean, a lot of crashes happen in the fog. And unfortunately, fog is usually a morning thing. And, you know, people are usually on the highways and going to work. So you do see a lot of crashes in these conditions. And, keep your eyes peeled. Keep your lights on.
I'd like to finish this by saying I'm not sure how many people know what their headlight knobs or stalk controls do at the different settings that they have. And it would be something that I would wish that drivers would learn when they are either having a new car or even if they have an old car and they don't generally have spend time knowing what the controls are. Older cars usually don't have auto, the term auto on their stalks or their knobs. All the newer cars seem to, and it would be my suggestion to listeners who are listening to this particular part of the show that they learn to set if their cars have the auto feature on them, they need to have them set no matter what the outside conditions are. But in fog conditions, the auto setting may not turn on the full set of lighting. And when I mean a full set of lighting, it is front and rear lights, as opposed to my earlier comment about DRLs, which is daytime running lights. I experimented with my auto setting versus on setting this morning. And obviously, when you're driving a car, you can't get out and look at the rear and the front to see what lights are or are not on when you have the different settings. But I know auto is mostly designed to turn on the full light systems when it gets dark at night, whereas DRLs don't change from what their settings are, which is basically front lighting conditions. That is a standard system in Canada. It does not seem to be necessarily a standard system in all new cars, Jay. I'm not sure. Maybe all new cars have the auto setting, but the older cars certainly don't. So if listeners, if you have newer cars with the auto feature and the daytime running lights automatically and they are working, and I see some newer cars with daytime running lights not on, so I'm not quite sure whether they are because the settings on your control stalk or knobs are controlling that situation, or whether maybe some cars aren't coming through with automatic daytime running lights that run all the time.
I can comment on that. It's very simple. Hyundai's, Toyota's for sure, and Lexus. If you turn the lights off, you do not have daytime running lights. Your daytime running lights only come on if you put the setting on auto. On other cars, the daytime running lights will go on regardless if you have them on or off.
Okay,
good to know.
Anyway. Thank you, Jay. So our listeners who are thinking of driving in fog, please remember to learn what your control settings need to be so that your lights are properly on during this kind of condition that we have been discussing for the past few minutes.
Moving on out of the fog.
Go ahead. Moving on out of the fog, we're going to talk about driving in Europe.
I just spent 2 weeks in Europe, and it was a great time, actually, and drove through the French countryside, to Paris and then through the French countryside for 3 or 4 days. And other than the fact that it's always a fun trip and great roads, what I do see, you know, and France and other European countries are pretty much the same. People have calmed down a lot over the last 10, 20 years since I've lived there. Drivers are slower than they used to be. I find it that people are actually driving around the speed limit or even under the speed limit. Obviously, photo radar and speed scanners have made it such that driving over the speed limit is becoming pretty risky. I also, and this is a beef of mine, as people who know me will attest to, people drive in the right lane. If there are three lanes on the highway, the trucks and the slower traffic, actually all of the traffic is in the right lane. And then you start moving over one or moving over two to make a pass. As soon as you've made a pass, you go back as far right as you can go. And yes, people seem to be cutting you, you know, in front of you, and it seems a little aggressive as far as driving is concerned at first, but it makes a lot of sense. And I was looking at the flow of traffic, and there really are no issues, no passing on the right, no weaving through traffic. So I think they've come a long way. I've also noticed, having gone to a few parties, that people drink a lot less when they go out. There is very... No, it's just, I think that the, DUI laws are such that, you know, with 0.025 alcohol limit in your blood, you are basically, if you drink more than a small drink, you are over the legal limit. And people are taking that very seriously and just driving a lot more sober, which is a good thing.
Jay.
Yes.
Is there more visual enforcement in the terms of numerical numbers of traffic enforcement officials in cars or otherwise on roads?
No. You usually get your speeding tickets in the mail. So in the next few weeks, I will know if I
actually... How many you got?
Yes. And there, you know, some of these... 30 Ks an hour, that's 18 miles an hour in the center of towns and cities, is a little brutal. But, you know, when you get used to it and you do see the benefit of it, you know, you're driving through very, well, first of all, as you know, Robin, the streets are a lot narrower than they are in most towns here in the U.S. You know, so driving at a slower pace makes a lot of sense. But 30 Ks is very slow. 18 miles an hour.
18 miles an hour, right, yeah.
Yes. What I do find is, you know, most of the radars are indicated. You will see signs on the side of the highways saying, hey, radar ahead. So if you miss a radar, usually it's because you're just not paying attention. So I'll let you know in a couple of weeks what my score is. Hopefully I don't get too many because I didn't drive all that much, but probably about, you know, 700-800 miles altogether, maybe 1,000 miles. Yes.
Do you use Waze in Europe?
No, I tend to use Google Maps, but Waze is used quite a bit.
Does Google Maps have notices of police ahead like Waze does many times? Notification of radar of let's say red light cameras or police, as Waze seems to do effectively or not in the United States.
I actually think they do,
but you don't know. Okay.
I'm pretty sure they do. I'm pretty sure Google Maps does. Anyway, fun driving experience. We're back here. We have to adapt to, you know, what our traffic laws.
We'll come back to the U.S., right, where we don't have proper driving habits.
Well, no, there's some,
in the multi-lane highways.
Well, let's say I think education and driving instruction is a bit flawed.
I'm not sure how driving instruction during driver education is effective in terms of teaching young drivers what is going on multi-lane roads. I spent much of my time driving to do this week's show in the right-hand lane of the highway system I was on. It was three lanes each way. I had my cruise control set on 72, which is what I do when the speed limit is posted at 65 on this particular road system. And I did not have, until I probably was on the right lane pretty much in this particular morning's trip, for 5 miles before I crept up on a slower vehicle that was also in the right-hand lane and had to move over into the middle lane and maybe at one point all the way over to the left lane to continue going at 72 or better. This is Jay and I have talked about this.
Ad infinitum about multi-lane driving U.S. style. And it would be nice if it could be, you could flip a switch and all of a sudden the Americans would get to be just like the Europeans.
I was just reading an article about in Motor Trend about comparing the cost. It was a study on comparing the cost of electric vehicles and ICE, gas-powered cars. And Motor Trend compared two Kias, very comparable vehicles, the Telluride SUV that's been around for 4 or 5 years now, and their new EV9, which is the electric, I was going to say version, but comparable vehicle, although it's a different platform. And they compared the cost of charging compared to the gasoline prices. And the difference in cost in fuel, quote-unquote fuel, is not as great as I thought it would be. Based on 15,000 miles a year, the EV9, the electric vehicle, was costing around $2,000 a year, which is only like $200-$300 less than the cost of a Telluride, the cost of gas. They were also noting that, you know, California has higher gas prices, but it also has higher electric prices. So there's a correlation between the cost of gas and electricity. So the study is, we'll say, valid. Maintenance costs for the EV9 is substantially less, or estimated as being substantially less than the Telluride. But then they were looking at the total cost of the vehicle, and the vehicle, the EV9, cost, I think, $25,000 more than the comparable Telluride. And even factoring in the $7,500 tax credit that we obviously no longer can benefit from, the EV9 was somewhat like $20,000 more expensive over the course of a five-year ownership period.
How is that based, Jay,
for
listeners? Is there any way to figure out how that's based? $20,000 more over 5 years for an EV?
Motor Trend went into detail in the cost of the vehicle, the cost of the financing, the residual value of the vehicle, taxes on one, taxes on the other. And they, you know, they put everything in a spreadsheet and they spat out that basically the EV9 cost $71,000 over the course of 5 years versus $52,000 for the Telluride. So
that is
$19,000 difference, not 20 plus, like I mentioned just a second ago. But it's still the cost of the EV is still higher than that of a gas.
Okay. That's fine.
Which is the problem of the industry, right? I mean, that's why EVs are not selling.
Okay, well, let me continue on the EV mode for a minute, because as this show is being done, the $7,500 credit for the EVs expired some days ago. But the electric sales apparently were quite successful. I guess that includes hybrid, too, for people who wanted to get the tax credit and get an electric car or a hybrid version of an electric gasoline car before the September 30th deadline, which passed that time. So I haven't seen the actual tables of sales, but I believe the electric car sales had quite a benefit for dealers who were selling them waning days of September.
Yeah, they did. Hyundai did very well. With the IQ5 and 6, and actually GM did very well. Even Ford with the Mach-E, their sales went up 50% relative to last. I'm not sure if it was last. I think their sales are up overall this year substantially over last year. But then again, their sales were way down compared to the year before.
Right.
By the way, nothing to do with this market, but when I was in Europe, I did see the new Ford Explorer in Europe is actually a rebadged Volkswagen ID.4.
Really?
Yeah, and it actually looks pretty good.
Was it easily like recognizable as a Ford version of the ID.4?
Yes, it has some of the characteristics of a Ford Explorer. It's just it's a slightly smaller package, and it's a fully electric vehicle. It's not the first time that Ford and VW cooperate, especially on the European market. This goes back to the 90s when they first started manufacturing and selling minivans under the Ford and VW name. You know,
right.
each of them.
VW was producing them, correct?
VW was producing them, I believe, yes.
And are they producing the Explorer, or is that a Ford-produced vehicle in a Ford plant in Europe? Do you know that?
I am not
that it makes a lot of difference.
Sure. Like
okay.
The saying goes, I will get back to you on that.
I'd like to go continue as we're waiting, running out of time in this week's show. back to the bicycles and bicycle travel moments that are going on in great numbers in around our listing area in the fall conditions, which are showing the trees to be multicolored. They are dropping leaves at a crazy pace in some areas, and the leaves sometimes fall on roads. And we have fortunately not had much rainfall as we do this show in recent days or maybe even weeks. So the roads are fairly dry, which is good. The leaves are fairly dry, which may or may not be good. But if you are on a bicycle and you are riding on our roads and there are leaves, clumps of them or otherwise evident in your pathway, and it has rained or they are wet, this is another safety factor for bicycles more than cars. Bicycle tires do not do well on slippery roads with leaves on them, as far as my not very recent experience, because I'm not riding a bicycle as much anymore. But I do remember when I was riding a bike more, and this condition was notable in my visual and route that I was riding a bike on. The other factor is in shadows, if you don't have bright clothing on, whether you are walking or bicycling, you are at risk in the afternoon light, which is getting less and less as the times as you go from 5 o'clock forward towards the nighttime. So drivers should be on watch for bicyclists and hikers and road walkers in these periods, these time frames, starting at 5 o'clock, especially if people are not walking with bright clothing. And we have some prep schools around here where the kids seem to have a lot of latitude and freedom to walk to and fro the village of Lakeville, and they are not aware, I don't think they are aware of how invisible they are as the dusk lighting approaches and continues into darkness. And I noted this on weekends, on a recent weekend, I don't know when they get to do this, but there were quite a few of our students at the nearby Hotchkiss School, for example, that were on the roads walking. And they were very invisible on some of the curves on the roadway that you walk from that school down to the shops, which is probably where they were going, and back to school. And they come down when it's daylight, and they go back after it's become darker. And it can be a very dangerous time for our drivers around here to be watching out for them.
I was just thinking about bike lanes, and
we don't have very good bike lanes, as you know. This is the problem with these white lines that depict either walking or I don't know whether they're supposed to depict a bicycle lane. Sometimes they are so narrow until you hit the earthen part of the road sides that you cannot ride side by side or walk side by side safely in some areas of our roads. Recently repaved, incidentally. So it behooves drivers to be able to maneuver around them if they have to, and that can sometimes result in crossing the yellow line, dividing the north and south or east and west routes. And you do not want to try and cross that line if you've got oncoming traffic at the same time. You're trying to avoid or give more room for a bicyclist and or walker that is trying to go the same direction you are going. Anything new in the car division we should know about? Cars are continuing to evolve technologically and visually. So
yeah, we're totally lost. Yep. A friend of mine last week was saying, you know, we can't fault. There are so many different cars now, so many models, so many brands. It's hard to follow everything, even, you know, car guys like ourselves. But what I do know is that some companies, some manufacturers are struggling out there. VW cars here. Alfa Romeo is really struggling in this country. It always was a very, small player. But now we're talking about Giulias and Stelvios selling in hundreds of units in a quarter, which is just...
not enough to keep them bringing them into the country.
No,
and they are probably tariff prone, and I do not know what the differential in the pricing of a new 25 or 26 Giulia is over what it was before a year or two ago.
But I'm still tire kicking one or two of those.
The values are out there for used vehicles. I still say to listeners, if you are contemplating having to financially avoid trying to get a new car, there are some good used vehicles out there, and they are, as we have said on this show many times, normally very well built if they're less than 10 years old, and will still have a lot of useful life in them and can be very fun to own, as opposed to trying to go out and buy the newest and greatest of the new vehicles that are offered. And they almost change monthly in what's going on, the way upgrades and updates are going as we head towards the 2026 model year.
So what's your next car?
Nothing as far as I can see. I've said to our listeners in other shows, I'm pretty well sorted out in terms of, and bought out in terms of what I look to be driving for the next several years. I am waiting. Am I waiting for anything to come? Oh, yes, a new Jeep Cherokee is going to be something I will look at very carefully. But as I have been thinking, if it doesn't have two knobs on the radio and or a couple of knobs on the heating
you're not going to buy it.
Air conditioning thing, I'm probably not going to buy it. For Jeeps, for our listeners who know Jeeps, the rugged ones, meaning the Wranglers and the various off-road trail hawk versions of the Jeeps, even though everybody says 98% of the people who buy these vehicles are probably not going to really take them off-road, Wranglers may be accepted. You think about a Jeep and you think about cold weather when they were making knobs, for the earlier versions, they were advocating that their knobs were big enough so that if you had a glove on, you could manipulate the knobs without much difficulty.
Heat in those vehicles?
What?
Does Jeep does not have heat in the vehicles?
No.
Well, why do they have to?
Has to do with the new Cherokee coming out. If they don't have knobs that you can grab with a gloved hand, I would be very, I do take my. I recently took my Cherokee off road and didn't need to use a knobs, but I was just thinking about how rugged it felt going up the trail I was taking, and you think about certain cars not having knobs anymore. You've got to go search for a push button or an arrow on a dashboard touchscreen, and this is where I think. Maybe we'll see some return to some logical knob tuning in the future.
All right. With that having been said, on the next program, knobs or no knobs?
Okay. We'll discuss it if we remember. This is Jay DeMarkin and Robin Leach on this week's version of Car Keys.
Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.